Hello, this is Dr. Peter Matthews at the University of Stirling doing another social policy podcast for the module SBC U913, Understanding Social Policy. And the podcasts have all been with academics. And today I'm sat in my kitchen to record a very different podcast with somebody far more important than an academic. So would you like to introduce yourself?
My name is Leslie Matthews. And I'm Peter Matthews' mother.
Yeah, she's my mum. And the reason why I'm interviewing my mum will become obvious with the next question. So can you just say, I know it's very rude to ask a woman her age, but can you say when you were born?
I don't mind being asked at all. I was born in March 1947.
So those of you who are studying this module, you should know that the founding of the welfare state in the UK is often referred to as that post-war Labour government from 1945 to 1950/51. And so you were born slap bang in the middle of that government.
I was actually born pre the NHS, which I think is an important point, actually.
Yeah. So because the NHS didn't come into being until, was it January
1948. Yeah. So I was born in a nursing home.
And then, so that probably would have been paid for through sort of some charitable contributions or Providence Society.
My father was working at that time, and he worked for London Transport.
So might have got some care,
some benefit in kind. I'm not sure.
Yeah,
or if I had some insurance, some private insurance. I just don't know.
Or workplace insurance.
Yes,
but then as well, there was healthcare through voluntary organisations, charitable hospitals, and also the local authority as well, weren't there?
The local authority had some health duties, but they were mainly, I think, of a preventive kind. Mm. Though there were clinics.
Yeah. And things had changed during the war, although obviously that was before your time.
Yeah.
So you're born in 1947, so you're what we refer to as the baby boomer generation of the post-war period. Can you talk about your childhood in London and what that was like?
Well, London, there were still bomb sites, and also housing was still a problem. Lots of private landlords and people living in pretty poor conditions, and indeed I was brought up in, when I look back on, and even at the time knew, were pretty poor conditions. It was a street of blocks of terraced housing, built probably pre-First World War. And a lot of them, not only ours, were divided into two. So you had somebody living at the top and we lived on the bottom. Like, they were flatted, but it wasn't a proper flat. You both shared the same front door, for example.
And so, essentially, you were overcrowded.
Oh, yes. There was a small scullery, cold water tap, no electricity. And then what would have been a room attached to the, there was a larder in the scullery, then a small room, but that we called the kitchen, and we all sat in it and listened. Listen to the radio, you're saying you haven't had any electricity. That's right. We had a radio with a battery with what they called an accumulator, and that had to be taken up to a shop to be charged every now and then. And then two bedrooms. Note, no bathroom.
Yeah.
An outside toilet, which actually wasn't down the end of the garden. You went out the back door and just turned to your right, and the door was outside, but it went into the house, as it were.
Yeah.
Fabric of the house.
Yeah. How long did you live in that property?
I lived in that till I was 19 years of age and left home.
Yeah.
And we only got electricity put in the late 1950s. And my mother sold her piano, a relic of previous good times, in order to get the cash needed to have electricity put in.
Yeah. So you lived in overcrowded conditions, pretty poor quality property until 1966, when kind of a lot of the sort of stories of the welfare state kind of point that suggest that problems have been resolved fairly swiftly, but it seems that that's not the case.
It happened for everybody, no, certainly not.
Yeah.
The significant factor in all of this was my father having a stroke in the early 1950s. I don't remember him as a well man, so it was before I was five.
Yeah.
And he couldn't work after that. He was a manual labourer. He couldn't work. And so we were basically living on what was then called national assistance.
Yeah. And then national assistance as well was one of the innovations of the welfare state. Mm. One of the National Assistance Act was one of the acts of Parliament the Labour government passed. What did national assistance mean in practice?
Well, of course, you have to think of national assistance in relation to national insurance. And Beveridge assumed that people would all pay into their insurance scheme. They would have benefits to which they had entitlement and rights through paying this national insurance. But there was obviously going to be a residue of people who hadn't been able to build up the contributions. And we fell into that. It was supposed to be a sort of safety net.
Yeah.
Well, it was a safety net with lots of holes in it.
Mm.
And even in those days, there was the sense of you weren't as good or morally right if you were claiming national assistance. There was a sense of shame about it.
Yeah. And also in that period, it was with the economy recovering from the post-war, from the war, it's a period of high employment.
Yes, that's
so
right.
Actually, from the vast majority of people wouldn't have been claiming
that's
benefits.
Right.
They would have been paying national insurance on the basis that they would never probably they claim their pension when they retired,
absolutely.
But not actually claim unemployment benefits
that's
or
right,
the other benefits that were available.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
So that sort of that conditionality that we find going right back to the poor law.
Yeah.
Is still there in that
post-war
absolutely. System.
Yeah, it's a thread that runs through from 1601.
And then, sort of, so national assistance provided your household with the main income.
Yeah.
What did that mean in practice?
Well,
then?
I don't know the exact amount. I do know our rent was very, very low. And, well, you would say, what landlord could honestly claim a lot for what we were living in? But rents were controlled, and the other big act that I do remember having an impact was the 1957 Rent Act, which meant if your landlord improved, and we'll put improved in inverted commas, the property, he could legitimately put up the rent, which basically meant in our case he took out the old black range, which was in the kitchen. Which
so the Victorian style range.
Yes, old black range, you had to black lead, where you could boil up some water on it. You wouldn't have to use the gas cooker out in the kitchen. Remember, we didn't have electricity for an electric kettle. And put in a gas fire.
Yeah, and that was counted as an improvement.
Yeah, it was counted as an improvement.
But I suppose, to be fair, on the Conservative government who introduced that Rent Act, that was because rent controls meant that landlords weren't investing in their properties.
Absolutely, they couldn't afford to, the landlords were saying. There was an element of truth in what, well, more than an element of truth, it was true.
Yeah.
We're not getting enough income from our houses to be able to invest and improve them, and we want to improve them for our tenants.
Yeah. So much as we might, even today, with the issues of housing, we might want rent controls, but there are costs to doing so that you experience. So your rents were very low. Then, so what the money that left over after you paid your rent, what kind of lifestyle did that leave you to live?
Oh, pretty poor. New clothing was unknown. So it was always hand-me-downs. And I had an older sister 3 years older than me, who's now sadly dead. But that stayed with her to adulthood. How can you shop in a charity shop? You know, we had to put up with all those hand-me-downs. And I can't.
So it was actually hand-me-downs from other people. It was hand-me-downs from
within the family. Yeah. Within the family mainly. But I do remember once, it's a very clear memory, that the early days of national assistance, you went up to some office in Ealing to collect it. And they must have, some of the staff must have thought, oh, this is a bit sad, isn't it? These poor families. Must have hearts of gold. And there was clothing you could get. And my mother got for me a maroon coat, child's coat, with what we called a highwayman's collar. It was been fashionable at that time. And on the one hand, I was very proud of this. It was probably in really decent nick, I have a vague recollection. But I also would walk around thinking, the child that once had this might see me in it and might come over and say, you're wearing my coat. So
is that everyday shame of poverty?
Yes, it was.
Grinds you down.
Yeah. And also, the only reason we had decent meat was my uncle, that's my mother's brother, was the manager of a butcher's shop in Mayfair. It's still there, Allen's of Mayfair, very high class butcher's shop. So we got a Sunday joint and which kept us going Sunday, Monday, Tuesday, and then sausages, I think, and mince later on in the week to keep us going through that. I think there wouldn't have been a lot of, or what meat we would have been pretty crummy if it wasn't for the fact that we were getting that. But under that National Assistance Act, if you were getting regular support in kind, as it was called, if that was known by National Assistance, they would have docked my mother's, my father's benefit.
So you
were living, looking over your shoulder all the time.
And you've talked to me before about when you got a TV.
Oh, yes.
Was that then?
Well, it was the late 1950s, I seem to recall. My father, disabled working class man, who only had ever known work, that was pretty awful for him. And so he used to go to the cinema every afternoon. But cinemas were closing down by the late 1950s. And my mother must have been able to rent it. Oh, she also worked on the side, by the way. This uncle who gave us the meat, also she cleaned his house for him. Well, him, his wife and family. Again, that was all on the side. So she must, and she was very good at managing money, my mother. She had to be. All her life, she'd never known anything other than poverty. It was either that or you were in terrible debt, and we never were. She managed to scrape together enough to rent a television. But you also had an annual visit from the National Assistance just to check up on your circumstances. And mother lived in fear of this and said, if they're coming, I've got to put, she'd like put a blanket over it, you know, to hide it. If they see I've got a television, they'll be suspicious that I'm getting extra money. And actually, somebody must have told on her, because she was angry, I remember, afterwards. And she said, they asked me, did I have a brother who lived on Southdown Avenue? And she said, no, I could say, no, I would never tell a lie. I don't have a brother living on Southdown Avenue. It was quite true. And she knew they were fishing. Or somebody said she goes out every day, because that's what she did. She went out every day to do this cleaning.
Yeah. So basically, in the contemporary discourse of benefits, she was a benefit fraud.
She was. Yes, she was.
To make ends meet.
It was the only way to keep your head above water if you were respectable. And my mother was very respectable and had aspirations for us.
Yeah.
And it was a source of anger from my father and bitterness that they couldn't provide in the way they wanted to. They had these two children. And two daughters, and they wanted them to have nice clothes.
In a society with growing affluence as well.
Absolutely. There was a photograph of me and my sisters when my dad was well. My mother and my sister, I'm in a pushchair, so it has to be before. And we'd gone to Butlins for a week's holiday. Imagine that. That would have been the very early 50s, probably about 1950.
Yeah.
And my mother once saying, when I was a bit older, you know, it's not your father's fault. You know, if he was only well, we would, you know, it would have been better for us.
So we sort of painting a pretty grim picture of the post-war welfare state here, of sort of living on National Assistance being really tough.
Yeah.
Really difficult experience of poverty, very poor housing conditions. So very different to a lot of the rosy pictures that are portrayed.
Yeah.
But the welfare state did benefit you in terms of the 1944 Education Act, in some ways, didn't it? So, because you went to grammar school.
Yes, I did. Yes, I passed the 11 plus, and my mother was delighted. She told the old woman upstairs, who didn't have children, oh, you know, Leslie's passed the 11 plus. My sister hadn't. And that's another story about division of siblings. Oh, Leslie's passed the 11 plus. Well, why are you so happy? You can't afford to send her there. And there was, again, some truth in that. Because you had to have the uniform. And yes, you applied for a grant, and there was from the local authority, and there was all the shame associated with doing that. But I remember my sister would have been leaving school at 15. Her blazer was royal blue. My blazer was going to be navy blue, so my mother dyed it. She got a badge. You had to have a badge on the grammar school from a neighbour whose older daughter, now having left the school, can we have the badge off it? And that was sewed on. I don't recall thinking I look as shabby as the rest, but I think shabbier than the rest. But I suspect I would have done.
Yeah.
And the thing that I do laugh about, actually, when I think about it, she went in the summer sales to the school suppliers, Abernethys in Ealing, and bought me, you had to have the proper shorts to do PE in. You're growing to them. during that era, these shorts came to my knees. I was still wearing them at 16. They still fitted. And I used to say, I would have been good at the high jump. I got over the bar. the shorts didn't. The shorts knocked the bar off.
Yeah.
How much I rolled them up around the waist, like a great sausage around the waist. So I can remember that.
So the education was there as an opportunity, but even then, it's just the situation.
Came with a cost. The woman next door to us, she had six children. The two boys had left home. She had four daughters. And I'm not romantic about the working class, although I'm proud of my working class origins. When it came to sitting the 11 plus, she didn't send her girls to school. What is the point of educating girls? And that is a very typical working class attitude. I suspect it's still around now in some areas. So my mother and father, who had aspirations, and who were both intelligent people, who because of their working class origins had never been able to benefit from education, were certainly going to make sure that I could, if I, you know, their daughter would if she could.
But that also reflects the wider gendered assumptions in your whole story as well. The fact that post-war welfare state was based on the model of a skilled male worker supporting a family. Yeah. So in your case, the skilled male worker wasn't there, so you're really, really struggling to make ends meet. And in the case of your neighbour not sending her daughters to school for the 11 plus, that's, well, it's okay because they'll get married to a man who will be at work.
Absolutely, yeah. Also, significantly, the bus depot was a big space of labour. Her husband was a driver, which was a skilled job. My dad was a cleaner.
Mm.
They were buying their house. We were just renting. Yeah. So these are the subtle differences. I'm conscious that you teach at a Scottish university. Remember, I'm talking about London, England.
Yeah.
And I don't know how much these things pervade also Scottish life. And perhaps in the big cities they would have. But certainly that was very significant.
And what you mentioned about Scotland, it was true there. And from my own research, I know that of particularly when the deindustrialisation first began in the 1960s with the sort of change in industry, and it was hit the low skilled workers first.
Yes.
And and the in Clyde Bank around Glasgow,
yeah,
you got growing, it was one of the first areas in the UK to experience growing unemployment in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And they didn't really understand why. It was because these very low skilled industries, food production, some of the very low skilled jobs in the shipyards were just going because they were being replaced by machines.
Yes.
And so people were being threatened. Yeah. There wasn't the work available in the local area.
Yeah.
So that was true in Scotland as
You're
well.
Right. Yeah. Okay.
So you went to your grammar school and you got your A levels.
Eventually, yes.
And then went off to Manchester University.
I did. Yes. Yeah.
So you managed to take advantage of that post-war expansion in the higher education as well.
Yes, yeah. I did. Yeah. Something I know made a huge difference to my life.
Yeah.
And in terms of being able to look back on it with a sort, because I did social policy at university.
Yeah, yeah.
So I'm able to get some sort of intellectual distance from it, which my sister, who became a hairdresser, never did.
Mm.
But that was interesting. Most of the girls of her era, including the ones next door, you just went down the Great West Road and got a job in one of the factories down on the Great West Road. But my mother, again, had this thing, you can have a skill that you can sell.
Mm.
You know, so trained to be a hairdresser, which was a job my sister didn't actually like.
Yeah.
Once she could give up, she did.
Yeah.
But it was the idea, I know my mother's point of view, you could end up being the breadwinner. And if you're the breadwinner, you're better off having a skill than ending up being a cleaner like me.
Mm.
So I know that would have been consciously thought of behind it all.
Yeah, yeah. And then, so you did social policy or social administration, as it was known. And then what did you go into then after your social...
I knew by then I wanted to be a social worker. Social work was expanding. There was going to be the changes in legislation in, I think, 72. But you could get in work as what they called an unqualified social worker. It horrifies me now, but that's what I did. And then you would be seconded by the local authority to get your certificate of qualification, your CQSW, which is what happened with me.
So again, the changes to the post-war state benefited you then, that expansion of social work from the late 1960s onwards.
Yes.
And I suppose, because that period, that late 60s period, was all that kind of Cathy Come Home, the rediscovery of poverty issues. How much were you aware of that?
Oh, very
that?
Much. Yeah. I was chair of the Child Poverty Action Group in Bradford when I moved there in 1969, about 1970 onwards. Yes. And Frank Field came and talked to us. He was the chair of it.
Yeah. So what was that poverty like then in the late 60s, early 1970s in Bradford that you were experiencing?
Well, there were still quite a few back-to-back houses. Yeah. I mean, the local authority was so putting
just
them
to,
down.
So just to explain, they were one up, one down. So basically two up.
You have downstairs, you had one room, and this what they called the cellar head kitchen.
Yeah.
So you had a cellar. And then upstairs, two bedrooms.
But then the fact was you had two of these houses. They're back to back.
Yes, they were.
Yeah. So you effectively had two rows of houses attached to one another. Yes. So they're very, very small.
Yes, yeah. Yeah. And single parents, and they were a growing number, were still extremely poor.
Yeah. And also stigmatised.
Definitely stigmatised. Yeah. All that stuff about the swinging 60s, forget it. There was still a huge stigma about being an unmarried mother. Yeah, there was still a lot of poverty. And Bradford had a lot of local authorities, so these large council estates, some of which would have been fairly newly built. But they didn't have central heating.
Yeah.
So the sort of things we take for granted were very cold. And people had their... And I did have families where they had their electricity cut off because they couldn't pay their electricity bill. So you had children living in houses where it was lit by candles.
Yeah.
Really dangerous.
Yeah. And did you... Bradford, most people know of it, or it has a reputation for the in-migration of people from Pakistan from the 1940s onwards. Did that... growing diversity of the city impact on your practice as social worker?
Well, in the early 70s, the pattern had been in the 60s, single men coming over and working in the mills at night. And some of them, in fact, I did have one family, would take a wife over here, white. Wife from the working class. Yeah. And so that was certainly from the early 1970s onwards. And then the mills started closing down. And then they started bringing wives over from Pakistan. And that continues to this day. And the pattern now is one partner would have been born and brought up over here. The other one's brought in from the Mirpur.
So to sort of go back to the timeline then. So you're in Bradford in the 1970s. And when did your mum eventually get a council property, a council house?
Right. Well, there was the formation of the Greater London Council in the early 1970s. I'm trying to remember, was it 1974? Certainly the early 1970s. As a result of that, small London boroughs were amalgamated. My mother was still living in that tiny little bottom flat, with the old lady still above, she'd been widowed by then, with my sister actually. And that was Ealing, which was a Conservative borough. It amalgamated with Acton and Southall, which were Labour boroughs, and so they had both invested in council housing. And so my mother was finally offered, having been on the council house waiting list for probably over 20 years, offered a two-bedroom flat in Acton, which she moved to. She wasn't on the top floor, she was just under the top floor. She loved it. She was an advertisement for Tower Block Living. She adored it. The views out, the lightness, the airiness. Bathroom and separate toilet. Well, of course, we always had a separate toilet, but it was outside the house, of course. So it was really, it was bliss. Those last few years of my mother's life were lovely.
Yeah, and all mod cons in the kitchen, I presume.
Well, don't know about that. She still had a washing machine and a spin dryer. I don't think, she might not have even had a washing machine. She certainly had a spin dryer. She loved a spin dryer. And it was a gas fridge for some reason.
It had gas in the box.
Oh, it did, yes. Now, Ronan Point, which of course is one of the tragedies. But Ronan Point was built by sort of blocks of concrete. And somebody, they had gas in it, but somebody, I do remember it all when it happened, thinking of my mother. But no, somebody had a friend put in a gas fire.
Yeah.
And the gas fire obviously hadn't been put in correctly and it blew out. And it was early in the morning, 6 o'clock. So that corner of the block that fell down, a lot of people were not killed because they weren't up yet for work.
So your mum got the council flat. Also, I believe the block of flats is famous.
Oh, yes. If you watch Only Fools and Horses, the credits at the start, which I think are Nelson Mandela House. No, they're not. They're Corfe Towers, South Acton.
Where your mum lived. Yeah. And then your first flat with my dad in Bradford was also a council flat.
It was,
as well.
So it was easy for us to get a council flat. We got married. In fact, we got a two-bedroom one, even though we didn't have children. Interestingly, that has since been pulled down. And it was certainly concrete and getting mould on it and all the rest of it. To my knowledge, my mother's, those flats are still up. They were well designed and well built in Acton.
So they sort of, you know, it's that the high flats is not just this story of awful antisocial behaviour and poor build quality.
No,
actually, some of them were good.
Yes.
And then you had my brother in 1979, and I was born in 1982. And so, obviously, under the NHS, unlike
myself.
You've told the story that you wanted to call, you were in hospital so long with me that you wanted to call me Neil Henry Stanley, so my initials would be NHS.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
Clearly that institution mattered a lot. And then also, so compare the, you gave up work when you had. Why was that?
Well, there wasn't, not so many women were doing it yet. I think we were on the cusp. We were all feminists. There were a group of us in the babysitting circle. All of us had had professional jobs and gave it up for about 6 or 7 years while our children were young. I think most of us only had two children. So there wasn't that. I didn't think of carrying on with work.
But I'm presuming things like that we take for granted now, like maternity pay or parental leave.
Oh, yes, that's right.
And childcare. Just weren't really on the radar.
Exactly. And the childcare wasn't as developed as it is now.
I mean, sort of childminder at one end or a nanny at another end.
Well, certainly not in Bretton North. Not in the north.
If you're on a public,
might have done in London,
especially if you're on a public sector income as well.
So you're very wealthy.
But still, sort of one of the last hurrahs of the welfare state did benefit you though as a mother in terms of child benefit.
That was paid to the woman. Paid to the mother.
So what would your mother received?
I don't remember the amount, but she would have only just got it for me, because she didn't get it for the first child.
Yeah, and that was family allowance.
It was family allowance, and I actually know this more from my social policy work. When it was first paid, there was almost a pre-feminist idea. It should go into the mother's purse, not the man, because not all men would hand it over.
So family allowance had that.
Yes.
But then, so how did child benefit differ from, so you pay for both children. So you went down to post office every week.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and just a nice, just a,
well, it was just a little bit extra. I remember sort of saving it up a bit.
So even though you in a household with a fairly decent income in the 80s, you were still receiving this benefit.
Yeah, it was
so
a universal benefit.
So there were no...
Administered by two ladies in Newcastle, I think, as opposed to any means-tested one, which needs an army of lower-grade civil servants to administer.
Which, National Assistance being a classic case, where you talked about having the inspectors come round every year, having to go down to the office and be assessed.
That's
because it's such a complex means-tested benefit.
Yeah.
A bit like universal credit today, which is going so well. So this last hurrah of the welfare state, this was essentially, it's almost a citizen's income. Yeah. If you had children, you got this money in terms of child benefit.
But the other thing you've got to remember, you're going on about, you were so long in the hospital. Yeah, I had two difficult pregnancies.
Yeah.
And I was looked after.
Yeah.
And you were, you know, both my children were. I had two healthy, normal babies at the end of it, which may not have been the outcome in a previous era.
So all in all then, in your life post-war, it's been a mixed bag. So there was some, you experienced the best of the welfare state in terms of a good education and the expansion of secondary education and then further higher education. You got a good quality job in a profession through the expanding state, and then the being a mother, you benefited from the resource of the state there, but then also some of the negative sides of it. So the fact that initial, as it was created in 1945, it was a system designed for households with a man in work.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. there was still that underlying assumption
that
that was how families lived, and how rapidly that changed, of course.
And I suppose that's something you would have seen in your work as a social worker as well,
how those
family dynamics changed,
how
I suppose it's we've ended up with a complex welfare system because people live complex lives.
Absolutely.
And all those sorts of the various ways families and households can have problems means that the welfare state has to respond to those. That very simple beverage model sort of breaks down.
I still give two cheers for beverage, you know. I say, I think back and I think I was very lucky to be born at that time, but very lucky to have the sort of parents who would support me when all down the street the other girls were going out to work. And also,
but so I suppose as well, your story highlights the what we now term resilience of your mother in particular in dealing with a very bad situation, or committing crimes essentially by committing benefit fraud, but to get the family on. And I suppose that in even today, when we have the sort of horrible benefit scrounger headlines in the newspapers, actually, if you look at the academic research on people who are out of work, people who are long-term unemployed, they still share that aspiration to work. It's just that they don't, the opportunities aren't there for them. Similar sort of conditions that people live in now. Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you, Peter.